As I say, I have the honor to talk to you about someone who has been part of my life for 50 years, a leading part of my life, and the reason that I stand before you today. Because without her, there is no me. Now, this year, as you were told, is the 125th anniversary of her passing. I am a great believer in celebrating anniversaries. When the Theosophical Society in England had asked me to give their Blavatsky lecture in the year 2000, celebrating the 125th anniversary of the society, I started off by telling them, to see where we have come from is to know where we are going. When you think of it, it really offers us a chance to see what we have accomplished and what lies before her. Anniversary centenary cycles have been part of this movement since its very beginning. Those of you who know the Mahatma letters, they talk about the first 7-year cycle finishing, where what was to be accomplished still needed to be done. HBB herself, to her own students, talked about at the end of the 19th century, the first 5,000 years of the Kali Yuga would end and there would be dramatic changes. There is that famous 1900 letter from KH stating that the Theosophical Society must be safely ushered in to the new century. So the society has had numerous anniversaries. 1925, great anniversary. Some of you who may know Dora Kunz, I once asked her in New York, were you at that 1925 gathering that was held under the Banyan Tree? 3 hours later, we had barely got to 1925. I felt that I was clairvoyant and psychic. She had been there, and it's the famous one where Krishnamurti was talking to the audience and switched from the third person to the first person. He's talking about the world teacher. He brings this, he brings that, and then I bring such and such. So, H.P. Blavatsky, she describes herself as, I am the mother and the creator of the society. It has my magnetic fluid, and the child has inherited all of its parents' physical, psychical, and spiritual attributes, faults and virtues, if any. So we are all children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren of HPB, so to speak. That DNA of hers has infused the society, and perhaps that is one of the things that has made it so successful and perhaps at the same time so quirky. I would like then to just talk to you about the HPB that I know, which is somewhat different than the HPB of books. As you know, she was born in what is now the Ukraine in 1831. Nancy Sechrest will be going in August, I believe. Is it August 12th?
That's her birthday. That's
yes. She will be there. In the building that HPB was born, giving a presentation. You may be interested to know in one of the scrapbooks, her scrapbooks at Adyar, one of the volumes actually has a page with an illustration where she has noted the room I was born in. I'll try to find you that citation. So born in Russia, feudal Russia in 1831, a sickly child. She had to be baptized right away. The priest who came, this is Russian Orthodox with those long robes, her aunt, a child herself, holding the candles. It was late at night. The child was nodding off. The candles caught the robe of the priest, and he was almost incinerated. So that sort of made her a person to be looked in askance on. She had a life of constant upheaval. Her father was in the cavalry. And you get the picture, she grew up as an army brat, so to speak. You can tell she really wanted to please her father. She was excellent at horseback riding. Her mother played a minimal part. Her mother was a writer, and you could tell her mother had no love of this frontier town living. Always spent her time writing. You got the impression that, you know, she was told as a child, don't disturb Mama. Mama is writing, don't. But her mother died when she was 11, and she went to live with her grandparents. Another formidable woman, the Princess Helena Dolgorukiy, the last of that line. And obviously by then, a very rebellious and willful person. She talks about her grandfather was the vice governor of a province, and of course there were ceremonial things to attend. She talks about being forced to attend a gathering party, which she adamantly refused to do, but they told her they would dress her or undress her, as the case may be, to appear in it. And she responded by putting her foot in a vat of scalding water. So she was horribly burned, so she could not go. So obviously this willfulness, this temperament, shows itself when she suddenly got married at the age of 17, just going on 18, to an older man, probably looking for freedom to get away from the life, the rigid life of her grandparents. That marriage lasted about 3 months. It was said that when the marriage vows were being said, and you had to repeat, you know, I will love, honor, and obey you, she said under her breath, I will not. So that marriage lasted barely a few months, and she was sent back to her grandparents, who in turn were going to send her to her father. They put her on board ship. This is an 18-year-old girl. Put her on board ship. She manages to bribe the captain, and instead of going to her father, goes to Constantinople. This would be the equivalent of somebody leaving Chicago and going to Louisiana, going to, say, New Orleans suddenly. An 18-year-old girl. Now, am I the only one who thinks that's kind of unusual, that an 18-year-old girl decides that she is going to decide her own life? 100 years later, I met many young people in the 1960s who were like that. But in the 1840s, this to me is one of the first most remarkable things. Here is a young woman who gets up and then plunges into the unknown. Constantinople, which is now known as Istanbul, was the great city where East met West. It was truly the edge of the Orient. We don't know how she supported herself. Some of her critics snidely remarked that she rode horseback in a circus. Nothing wrong with that. She was a good horseback rider. She disappears. 2 years later, she suddenly is in London, and she writes that she is there overlooking the Thames on Waterloo Bridge, ready to plunge in. Imagine, at the age of 20, life no longer has anything for her. So 18, she runs away. By 20, she knows the world has no more meaning for her. And this is when she meets her teacher, as she says, the man of her dreams. There are many discussions about where it was, how it was. I am not going to relate too much, because in my new book about her, I will deal with this story. And then again, she disappears, totally disappears for about 20 years. There is the story that she went to America, went to New Orleans, went to the coast of South America, and then to India. There is, interestingly enough, in the archives at Adyar, a treasure map supposedly showing where all of this Inca gold was put. She claims that an old Indian showed her the way. She reappears in Cairo in 1870 and starts her own society called the Spiritual Society. That lasts about 2 weeks. And then the next time we hear about her, she is in New York. We finally have discovered only this year the date of her arrival. This was something that was unknown. We know now that she arrived on July 8th, 1873. A year later, she applies for US citizenship. Soon as she gets it in 1878, leaves the country. She meets Colonel Olcott, which is a dramatic change of events for both of them. Colonel Olcott was a prominent lawyer. He had investigated Lincoln's assassination, as you all know. They meet, and a friendship forms and a bond forms between them that would last till the end of her life. In New York, in Irving Place, at her rooms, a meeting is going on. People have gathered. She always has people gathering around her who are interested in the spiritual life. And Olcott says, wouldn't it be a good idea to form a society to investigate such things? And the society is born. She herself feels that September 7th, the date of that meeting, is the actual date of the birth of the Theosophical Society, not November 17th that we celebrate, which is when Colonel Olcott gave his inaugural address. Instead of being involved in the TS, she goes off to Ithaca, New York, and starts writing Isis Unveiled, or what becomes Isis Unveiled. The family she visits, the Corsons, Professor Corson had been a professor at English Literature at Cornell. He had lost his daughter a year before and obviously thought that HBB could put him in contact with her. In fact, she suggested everything to the opposite. At that time, she was still a smoker. And they begged her, of course, Ithaca is a very small town. They begged her not to smoke in public. They took her out for a ride to see Lake Cayuga. It's a beautiful part of the country. Autumn was just starting. But as Professor Corson's wife wrote to her son, the poor woman could not restrain herself and had to sit by the side of the road and take a few whiffs. The society starts. It lasts about 2 years. Colonel Olcott, who was paying the bill out of his own pocket, they met at Mott Memorial Hall on Madison Avenue. It is no longer standing. Members were indifferent. They could not even get a third person to form a quorum at the meetings. Colonel Olcott said that they had to depute the chandelier to be a third person, and their last thing as they left New York for India was to bade goodbye to the chandelier, which had been one of the most fateful members of the society. Now, here again is something else. Okay, you start something, it doesn't succeed the way you hoped, imagined, but yet they still kept on with this thing. It had some meaning. It had some drive, some impulse. Okay, it didn't work this way. Let's see if it works this way. Of course, she writes Isis Unveiled. She didn't leave that apartment on West 47th Street for 6 months, just writing and writing and writing and writing. And the book ends up being 1,200 pages. My abridgment will be there for only 200 pages, so taken out. It's a hard thing to take out over 1,000 pages of any author. It's interesting that I did that abridgment actually in the building she had wrote the book. I was living there at the time in New York. And I must tell you, the book did itself. It wasn't something that I sat down to do. It's quite remarkable that the book just cut itself through. It was just a wonderful experience. They go to India. Now, India in 1878, 1879, is not a place you would have gone for spirituality. India was the black hole of Calcutta. It was somewhere you sent missionaries to, doctors to, but it was not a place you went for spirituality at all. They go to India with this idea of India being the spiritual matrix, the place where spirituality is still alive. They tour all over that country. You can imagine now this heavyset woman wearing all of the clothes at the time, black, heavy skirts, touring everywhere, seeing everywhere. As she points out, they stayed in what was known as Blacktown. India was very segregated. The British, it was sort of like an apartheid situation. The British lived in their own cantonments, and the Indians lived elsewhere. She traveled with Indians. Truly, Colonel Olcott and Madame Blavatsky saw India as very few Europeans had seen India before that. Quite remarkable. She goes everywhere, sees everything, is traveled throughout the entire country. They buy a headquarters in Madras at that time because the railroad had opened up to the Nilgiris and people could go up to the mountains for the summer. They chose Madras. They had initially been in Bombay because it was central. Central to the north, Calcutta, central to Bombay, central to their work in Sri Lanka. The Theosophical Society was the first all India movement. This is at a time when India is cut up into princely states. There was no India as we imagine. There were a number of separate countries, states, each with a different language, each with a different administration. The Theosophical Society was the first movement that bridged all divides, all languages, all races, all ethnicities. She goes to Europe in 1884. Colonel Olcott was such a great, was admired so greatly in Sri Lanka. He started Buddhist schools for Buddhist children. And the Buddhists had asked him to go to London to press their case before the colonial office. They were not getting any redress. Here again, imagine, we complain about traveling today. Here is somebody who traveled on a bullock cart, which means it's a cart with a bullock pulling it with wooden wheels with no traction through places where there were roads, no roads. He lectures sometimes. Sometimes he was the first white face that anyone saw. He drew a crowd, as he said, sometimes out of curiosity. People came to see him. He would speak at night. They would set up two torches. He said by the end of the night, the torches had attracted a mass of insects who had simply landed on his beard. So his face was a wriggling mass of insects. But all that, they go to England. She's feted. Suddenly, you know, she's the talk of the town. Everybody wants to meet her. The society is flourishing. 95 lodges in India, while the rest of the world has about 15. Right when she's at the apogee, again, a strange story. News comes from India about some letters that are going to be published in a missionary journal claiming that she has done fraud for all of her phenomena. They go back to India. The general council meets. They decide she wanted to sue for libel. The general council decided it was not worth suing. She is in a terrible state. Olcott said it was terrifying to see her marching up and down the roads with her eyes bulging out, condemning everybody as being disloyal. She's sent off to Europe and ends up settling in a little town in Germany, Würzburg, Germany, where she then sits down to answer her critics and writes The Secret Doctrine. One of the charges against her is that she had done all of this in the Theosophical Society as a front for being a Russian spy. And so she sits down and writes The Secret Doctrine, and as she says, this will show them what a Russian spy can do. So She, of course, has another near-death experience, almost dies in Belgium, comes to England in 1887. A group of people gather around her, all young people. These people are all in their 20s and 30s. We think of them being older people because we think of seeing pictures of them older. Annie Besant was only 40 by the time she joined in May 1889. Really, people who wanted to do something for Theosophy, because before that it was simply a study group. People met, they read, they studied, they discussed. But they wanted to be more active. And as pointed out, here her most productive period starts. The Secret Doctrine is published, which starts the beginning of the Theosophical Publishing House. It's the first book. They decided to publish it themselves. Then comes in rapid succession the book she's known for, Key to Theosophy, Voice of the Silence. She starts her own group within the society as an esoteric section for people who really wanted to serve. The basis of her school was not just to study and study more abstruse things, but to form a group, a nucleus, whose work would be to work for the Theosophical Society. And of course, then you know she dies very suddenly in May 1891 from the influenza epidemic that is sweeping London. Influenza was no joke at that time. During the First War, over 14 million people died from influenza. And everybody was really shocked that she passed away because she had lived through so many other illnesses. But she dies very peacefully sitting in her armchair, two people around her holding up her head. They said she passed so quietly that there was just almost the breath had simply stopped. And her last words were, of course, keep the link unbroken. Keep the link unbroken. This, I think, is her great message to us, to keep that link unbroken. In one of the letters she quotes from the Master, she says that as long as there are three men worthy of the Master's blessing, the Theosophical Society will never be destroyed. Not 30, not 100, three. As long as there are three who are keeping that torch alive, this message will never be destroyed. So that's her life. That's the Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. But what about H.P.B. herself? She is known to us today because of her great literary output. Truly remarkable for somebody who had not written in English before 1874, and has a multitude, 14 years is really all she had, and she simply churned out. I have developed a really great mnemonic to focus on her writings that tells you all about her writings, and this is it. Take notes. Okay. There is a road, steep and thorny, beset with perils of every kind, but yet a road, and it leads to the heart of the universe. That is, in summary, the message of Isis Unveiled. That is really what Isis Unveiled is all about. It tells you that there has been this tradition, this great ancient wisdom religion that has existed through all time and still in existence today. It is a road, it is a path, it is a means, and it leads to the heart of the universe. Now, in saying this, I am not saying that you shouldn't buy my abridgment, but it may expound, it may give you some scenery on that road. The next part of this is, I can tell you how to find those who will show you the secret gateway that leads inward only and closes fast behind the neophyte evermore. This is pretty well the world of the Mahatma letters. If you look at the Mahatma letters, it's all about to find those who will show you the secret gateway that leads inward only and closes fast behind the neophyte, the person who then wants to make an expression on the path. Next, there is no danger that dauntless courage cannot conquer. That's the message of the secret doctrine. There is no danger that dauntless courage cannot conquer. You pick up that book, and believe me, you need dauntless courage. As you know, I work in the library in New York, and I had a girl come in. She said, she wants to borrow the secret doctrine. She wants something to read over the weekend. So, of course, yeah. Okay. But it challenges us. It challenges everything we need to know. And people pick up that book and they think they're going to understand it all. But you're not supposed to understand it all. If you understood it all, you'd be an adept. You'd be a Mahatma yourself. It's not so much to fill you with more information, but to train you to think in new and different ways. So many people get caught up and stopped. Well, what does this mean? And I don't understand this. And it is like mental calisthenics. You know, just simply read it and go through. It is like if you're walking along the beach and you stubble your toe, do you just simply stop walking? You know, you walk on, you go on. Now, the next part, I'm halfway between these two. So there is no trial that spotless purity cannot pass through. There is no difficulty that strong intellect cannot surmount. I am still debating which one is the key to theosophy and which one is the voice of the silence. There is no trial that spotless purity cannot pass through. Perhaps that could be the key to theosophy, because its great message is hope and responsibility, or reincarnation and karma. We have the ability to make the changes in our life. This is a dramatic message in the 18th century, in the 19th century, where if you were a Christian, Jew, or Muslim, you were a wretched sinner who had no control over existence. But you have the ability, you have that power to make those changes in your life. You have the ability to drive your karma, so to speak. And then there is no difficulty that strong intellect cannot surmount. The Voice of the Silence, a wonderful, remarkable little book. It's dedicated to the few. And what I will point out in this next session of mine on the esoteric instructions, I think that was really written for her school. Because if you read the material that she issues to her students, there's nothing about meditation or all of those things, but it holds up this wonderful ideal of self-sacrifice for humanity. To live to benefit mankind is the first step, to follow the six paramitas the next. This idea of altruism, which is different than compassion. We seem to get these things mixed up. We talk a lot about compassion, but altruism is very much different about compassion. Compassion is, I feel your pain, I'm working for you. Altruism is you before me, your needs, the captain going down with the sinking ship. The ideal in the 19th century of Florence Nightingale, who went into the Crimea. Father Damien in the leper colony in Molokai, you know, who went there. There was no cure for leprosy. These people were dropped off on that island in the most horrible way. And this Belgian priest went there and devoted his life to caring for them. He, in turn, developed leprosy. In fact, HBB says that they were taking up a collection for him in the Blavatsky Lodge, but the poor man died in the interim. And then, for those who win, onwards, there is reward past all telling, the power to bless and save humanity. I think this is what her esoteric school is about. The power to bless and save humanity. Reward past all telling. And then it ends by saying, for those who fail, there are other lives in which success may come. So again, this message of hope, that it's all up to you. You can make it if you only try. Don't stop reaching till you touch the sky. How much time do I have left for this thing? Okay. So, okay. So I'll end with this question of who was HPB? Colonel Olcott, who knew her, writes that none knew her so intimately as I. None save me saw her in all her many changes of mood, mind, and personal characteristics. This is somebody who knew her from 1874 till she died. Just because I did know her so much better than most others, she was a greater mystery to me than to them. It was easy for those who only saw her speaking oracles, writing profound aphorisms, or giving clue after clue to the hidden wisdom in the ancient scriptures to regard her as an earth-visiting angel and to worship at her feet. She was no mystery to them. But to me, her most intimate colleague, who had to deal with the vulgar details of her daily common life and see her in all her aspects, she was from the first and continued to the end an insoluble riddle, right? She was an insoluble riddle. Imagine, this is Colonel Olcott, who knew her so intimately. W.B. Yeats, the poet who knew her, describes her, he says, she is simply a note of interrogation. So people saw in her what they needed to see. Of course, we know her as the teacher, this great inspirational figure. She, of course, is known for her self-sacrifice, her work for the society unparalleled, writing 12 hours a day. Imagine she'd wake up early by 7 o'clock, have a cup of coffee, and sit down and just write, write, write. Got a fountain pen, I think, in 1887. So she was using ink all of that time. And if you've written for any length of time, you find that the nub of the pen actually starts making an indentation in your hand. They said she could write and roll a cigarette at the same time. You could tell how well she was doing by how many cigarette butts were there. In fact, as she lay dying, her last act was to roll a cigarette for her doctor. Of course, somebody who smoked at one time 200 cigarettes a day didn't die from emphysema or lung cancer, but certainly could smoke. She was smoking. But I think in answer to this question, because I think you have some questions about all of this, I will let her end with her own writing in a letter of hers. She writes that HPB is not infallible. HPB is an old, rotten, sick, worn-out body, but it is the best I can have in this cycle. Hence, follow the path I show, the masters that are behind, and do not follow me or my path. When I am dead and gone in this body, then you will know the whole truth. And since that time, since 1891, we have been struggling to come to grips who was HPB. I will just conclude on this one message. The Journal of the Theosophical Society and Insight, in England Insight, republished this year for May, a talk I did at ADR for White Lotus Day in 1984. And I also, it has this quote from her that I think sums her up and describes her, I think, how she would like to be remembered. I write, why did she do it? We get a glimpse when she says, unswerving devotion to him who embodies the duty traced for me and belief in the wisdom collectively of that grand, mysterious, yet active brotherhood of holy men is my only merit and the cause of my success in occult philosophy. And then I'll just read you the summary that I write here. Here we have the key to that riddle of contradictions known as HPB. This loyal sense of duty to the cause of truth, which the motto of the society reminds us, there is no religion, no dharma higher. This perhaps is her most enduring lesson to us, a lesson each one of us can utilize in daily life. For like her, we are often thrown into situations not of our own making, nor of our own particular liking, situations which, in our microcosmic world, are more momentous than global affairs. But if we could tap this force, this dwelling latent in the heart of each man and woman, this dedication would transcend all obstacles, truly move mountains. We would then become active co-workers with HPB in a grand evolutionary cycle for the benefit of humanity. And if that's not something worth striving for, I don't know what is. Well, thank you.
Michael, there is absolutely no question by any of us the commitment that you have made to coming to know this woman. Tell us what drove you to that.
Madness. Absolute sheer insanity, I suppose. There's a line in the Vedas that the gods choose the rishis don't choose the gods. I came across her in Toronto, I guess 1964. I came across a picture of her. It's a picture of her and Colonel Olcott. It's a very famous one with the tobacco basket. And there was something about literally time stopping. If you've ever had this experience where just suddenly everything stopped. And so I wanted to know more about this woman. And at that time, the only thing you could find were encyclopedias, and everything said she was a discredited medium. There really was not a lot written at that time. The next year, I got my parents to give me a copy of Isis Unveiled as a Christmas present. You may think I was very disappointed from the title, but I read through it, and read through it over the Christmas holidays and was just hooked. Totally hooked, not only from her, but this whole world that she opened up. I think you should really read her with an uncritical mind of saying, oh, she's wrong here. She was like Scheherazade with 1,001 stories, just telling you about ancient wisdom, about Platonists, and just endless things. The Orient, wonderful, wonderful descriptive things. I joined the society in 1968 at the age of 17, which was the legal age in Canada at that time. And I really got the bug. That lodge, by the way, was one of the last signed by her. It was chartered in April 1891. And in fact, it produced the first woman doctor in Canada, produced the second woman doctor in Canada, who was her daughter. In those days in Canada, women could not get a medical degree. She had gotten her degree in England, some great writers, editors. It produced Alfred Smythe, who was the general secretary for about 40 years. He is most famous for his son, Connie Smythe, was the person who built Maple Leaf Gardens, which became the temple of hockey. Before that, hockey was not, until you had that great rink and Connie Smythe actually was a member at one time. And that started to leave. At that time, there still wasn't a lot available. Olcott's old diary leaves were out of print. So I started writing to a lot of people. I even remember writing to Joy Mills here, writing to the archives at Adyar. The last of those great Adyar archivists, Zoltan Dalgea Pap, who Janet is doing some research on, was so kind. Somebody you didn't know from Adam, sending me a whole page. This is the list of articles. This is a picture. And it was like a snowball. There was a momentum that started carrying me. I found there was a library in British Columbia that had actually been started by one of her pupils, one of her inner group pupils, Alice Clether. Went out there. The old lady who was running it was now confined to a wheel. No, she wasn't in a wheelchair. She was in a walker. She was in her 90s. She had ridden a motorcycle till she was 90. Her only vice, she said, was going to Las Vegas once a year with her 60-year-old son because she always won. playing the slots. And she was walking down her street, and some kid with a bicycle knocked her over, and it left her immobilized. And I said, you know, you've been so active. Don't you, you know, miss that? And she sat there, and she said, she pointed, she had her secret doctrine and her Mahatma letter. She said, no, I have the universe at my fingertips, wow. Right? And it just kept moving and moving, and came to New York for my career and working in the music business. In public relations. I think if I have any great talent, it's about creating images, creating... HPB, when I first met her, was sort of a dowdy, frumpy person, and nowadays she is the go-to figure. Cambridge has just issued this handbook of Western mysticism and esotericism, and there she is, along with Paracelsus and the Rosicrucians, as one of the great influences in our philosophy. I should also do a plug for a Quest book, by the way. Those of you who want to know more about her, this little book is an excellent, excellent introduction to HPB. I think Das and I are the only two people who are still alive out of the 28 people in this book. I think John Algio and Adam Warkup. But it's a great introduction, and still only $8.95. So I ended up actually, when I went to New York, I ended up living in her home. I knew what it was. It was what's called SRO, single room occupancy. You know, it had been cut up into little rooms, a little sink in the room. This building was so old, and they had done so little to it. There were no wall outlets in this building. Can you imagine New York at the end of the 20th century, a building where there were no wall outlets, no plugs? You could still see where the gas jets were. And it's true, there were times when I said, can a person fall in love with a place? You know, because I truly love that little place. It was just something special. Now it has been cut up further and it's now a travel lodge and everything has been changed around it. So I would look out the window seeing the same views she had, seeing Colonel Olcott describes that after one night at working in Isonsudville, he was sitting in his room and thinking over some things. And out of the corner of his eye, he sees this figure in white. And there is the Mahatma. And Olcott, of course, being a legal man, now thinks, am I dreaming? Is this a vision? Has HPB hypnotized me? And the master takes off this turban and leaves it there for him and then discusses the work ahead. But Olcott being Olcott, and then goes out the door and then disappears. Olcott being Olcott, I'm sure must have gone down to the end of the hallway and seen, in those days, there would have been a latch on the door, not a key, you would have had a latch, seen if the latch was still there, you know. And believe me, if you open that door with his room, the rooms were really tiny also. If you open that door, you would have seen anybody leaving. So then this thing keeps steamrolling and steamrolling, and finally when I was freed from the record business thanks to the music business tanking by 1980, which was vinyl became history and CDs and all sorts of other digital technology was taking over. I wrote to Adyar about getting something copied for one of the scrapbooks. I think Dr. Jean Raymond was still international secretary then. And they said the scrapbooks were too fragile to be copied. So, well, if the mountain won't go to Muhammad, so I said, well, can I come and see the scrapbooks? And of course, they said yes. And it was just so wonderful to go through all of those scrapbooks that she had put together. There's over 30 volumes of just press clippings, and I hope one of the things that will be done will be to digitalize those, because they are truly a treasure. Sometimes good intentions can be the worst. C.G. Narayanadasa, a past president who was a great lover of the archives, decided to preserve them by covering them with cellophane and shellac. And that all that has done is made them brittle and brown. But there's tons, and just it's amazing to think how much publicity this movement got in the early days. I mean, when she died, it was world news. She was on the cover. She was on the front page of the New York Times, the Times of London. All the New York papers covered her. Quite remarkable. So it was like a force. I didn't think, oh, I'm going to do this. After a while, you just went with this thing that just kept going and going and going. And, you know, ADR kept pulling me back, though I kept running, and it would pull me back. And I think our president and first lady have just experienced summer in India. Wait till you go through a full year cycle. Even our international president, Radha Bernier, would leave during the summer to tour Europe while the rest of us would just become a puddle, a ball of sweat hanging on your nose that would just never seem to leave. And it just kept growing and growing. My first book, The Dawning of the Theosophical Movement, which Pete Peterson chose the title for, which in India, I was once introduced as the author of The Downing of the Theosophical Movement. Pete Peterson chose the title. Robert Elwood was my reader. And it was suggested to me by Dora Kunz, right in downstairs at that table. Dora and Shirley Nicholson, we were sitting down there, and she said, well, you've been to ADR, why don't you write a book? I was just so taken aback, and because the centenary of the American section was coming up. Well, you've been to ADR, why don't you write a book, right? And I did my best, and I remember going up to Cornell with an old portable typewriter. So outrageous in those days, you know. But just, as I say, the momentum kept going till it pushed the personality aside. Yes, a personality is our quirks, our habits, but then something else begins to generate. And one of the greatest things to be able to be the medium to make her book so much accessible. My editor over here, Mitch Horowitz, after I had done ISIS, he came in. He was doing research for his own book, excellent book, by the way, Occult America. He came into the library and he didn't know me. He said, do you know Michael Gomes? Usually when I'm asked that question, I say, why? But I think, what now? What now? I said, well, I suppose as good as anyone. And he simply said, well, if you have anything, and I had had that abridgment that I'd worked on in The Secret Doctrine, and it really got published. And in fact, if you put in Blavatsky and Amazon books, the Secret Doctrine is the first thing that comes up. The second thing that comes up is the abridgment of ISIS Unveiled. So it is still being sold and still reaching people all over the world. And then I was offered the work to transcribe all of this undiscovered material. The transactions, the Blavatsky Lodge, they had done a stenographic report of it. The book is 400 pages, and transcribing, you know, her replies back forth, all of her questions, answers, you know, but also people, you're so lucky, it's so wonderful. There's also a psychic toll that is taken by these books. To have to concentrate so minutely on so many points, it's not something I would recommend to anyone easily, as John Knieble will find out sooner or later. But it's just a velocity, and then you reach a point where it's no longer about H.P. Blavatsky or H.P.B. It's about this dynamic force that is still operating in the world for good. This tremendous energy that it's like a keynote that struck or an avalanche that's still working in the world today. As I say, now she is regarded as a seminal figure in the world of academic studies. The only sad part is academics think they know more than theosophists about theosophy. But she really has become a dynamo, and perhaps when I'm dead and gone, hopefully that I will have made her a little more understandable and accessible. All I can tell you is she has been there for me when no other has. There's a lovely line from Annie Besant about theosophy, what it meant to her. She said she followed it regardless of what human ties be broken or friendships failed her. HPB has been there for me when I've shed a tear, when I'm happy. She had this habit when she was writing of just sort of gazing into space. And maybe she was looking to the future and saw the work that we are all still carrying on today, this ability to keep the link unbroken. So if you ask me about her, she's not a question mark, but she's a really dynamic power and force. Anyone else?
Thank you.
Anyone else? But why? To quote our late president, Rada Bernier, this is not an entertainment. Yeah. There is no need for applause. Any other questions before?
Any other questions?
Michael, where did you find the information about when HPB came to America? I'm curious about how that
happened.
It's
just been discovered. You know, there really are an informal network of people who are doing research now on her, and on one of my colleagues has just come across the actual ship manifesto where she's listed as coming on July 8th, 1873. So they are planning to publish something on it.